Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hello, and welcome to Your Book, the podcast for literary nosy parkers. I'm Daisy Buchanan, your host and the author of The Sisterhood, a love letter to the women who shape me. For our fifth series of Your Books, we're in the USA, and today we're coming to you from Book Soup, the bookshop in West Hollywood, Los Angeles. Our guest isn't just a West Coast resident. Her latest book is, among other things, a love letter to California. We're with Taylor Jenkins Reid, and Daisy Jones and the Six, her smash hit sixth novel, is a story of the highs and lows of fame, passion, pain, creativity, and being in a band, told as an oral history. When the novel came out last year, it was all any of my friends could talk about. Everyone I know started their copy and looked up from it blinking a few hours later, having inhaled it. It's an extraordinary, vivid and addictive story, and Taylor researched it meticulously. So we talked about music memoirs, as well as kids' books, Hollywood history, and the joy and pain of looking for your own work in the bookstore. Yeah, here we are in West Hollywood, in Book Soup. Taylor, do you come here often?
You know, I actually do. I don't. We're in West Hollywood. I live in the Valley, which anyone that's seen Clueless knows. You know, the Valley is a totally different, separate part of Los Angeles. But I love Book Soup. It's such a great bookstore. And we don't have that many independent bookstores in Los Angeles anymore. And so this one, oddly enough, in terms of independent bookstores, this is one that's closest to my house. So I'm here a lot. I do events here a lot. I like to just wander through the stacks because it's also got a real, like, intense library vibe too, which I like. So
can you remember the last thing you bought in here?
The last thing that I bought was I was probably here for an event. I don't remember the last book, but it's been so many. I also buy a lot of children's books here for my daughter. So I buy a lot of the, like, ABCs of engineering and ABCs of mathematics and stuff like that, which every time I'm here, I pick up one of those.
Oh, cool. Well, should we have a look at this table here? Because this is the store recommended pile. Is there anything in here that takes your fancy? I think I'm going to buy this book.
You know, Jello Girl, I really want to read that. That's been on my list to read. The Great Believers is next on my list.
Oh, so I don't know The Great Believers.
Oh,
by
this
Rebecca
is both
nominated for the National Book Awards.
Everything that I've heard about it is spectacular, so I'm really excited for that one. It's sitting on my nightstand.
So what's it about? Pitch it to me.
Oh, geez.
Imagine you're selling me.
Pitching
the book
a book I haven't read is tough, but I believe that it's set in the 1980s against the backdrop of the AIDS crisis, and it's supposed to be just spectacular. This one, which I know everybody talks about, but I read this a couple months ago and loved it, Conversations with Friends by Sally Rooney. Have you read it yet?
Yes.
Yeah. It's very... I just really loved the writing. She has an incredible ability to describe things in a way that makes you feel like you're experiencing them.
Because I love that book is so focused.
It's
a very, very close reading of all of these
different relationships.
Yes, it's
very narrow and intimate and almost claustrophobic, but I really liked it. The Body Keeps the Score, which is on the table, is the one that my therapist is always telling me to read.
Ooh.
I feel like every therapist tells people to read this book. I should probably buy it. It's important to do what your therapist says.
This trauma is a fact of life. Veterans and their families deal with the painful aftermath of combat. Do you read much kind of nonfiction and much science?
You know, it really depends. Lately, I've been reading so much in order to blurb. And so all the things that I'm sent are fiction, and I read those. But I love reading nonfiction, like Jello Girls, for instance. Like, I really want to read that. It's tough for me to find time to read the books that I'm really, really excited about, even though I'm getting sent books that I'm also excited about. But it's, you know, I'm trying to support them. And so
it's the loveliest thing, and kind of the worst thing as well, that I think we're all going to die not having read what we wanted to
read. I know.
So much.
I think that's why I like books so much, though, is that you will never, that feeling of, I want this one, I want this one, I want to read this one, you know, it's like this way of being sort of intellectually greedy that that I really like.
Is there anything that you've blurbed or that you've been sent that you're really excited about that you want to talk about?
You know, there's a book that's going to come out next year that I just finished and I just blurbed. I thought it was great, and it's called When a Star is Bored. And it's a, it's fiction, but it's sort of loosely about Carrie Fisher. The author that wrote it, his name's Byron Lane, and he was Carrie Fisher's assistant for a period of time in his life. And so this is this just sort of beautiful friend love story that you know, about these two people and their relationship that I thought was really touching. And I, you know, I loved Carrie Fisher when she was alive, and I miss her now, and you're reading it and it feels like she's there, you know? And so I really loved that one.
Oh, fantastic. Because I love her books so much.
Yeah.
To do justice to that voice.
Exactly.
The challenge.
That, and I really think he does. I really think that when you're reading it, it feels like she's there, which is such a tall order, and he really nails it. So it's going to be a good one.
When you wrote Daisy Jones, was there a lot of sort of ideas that were there because of books that you'd already read and loved, or did you have to do a lot of research to kind of get the time and get the 70s?
That's a good question. You know, in terms of structure, it's written as an oral history, which is not a way that we tend to write fiction. So there wasn't really much that I was looking at in terms of the structure of the story, because it was nothing I had seen before, even though it has been done before.
So, but you went in just, this is what I'm going to do. Was it always that way in your head?
Yes. Ooh. Yeah. You know what? It was because of reading nonfiction that I really enjoyed. That is, you know, sometimes we, oral histories are typically nonfiction, and those things can be, like, there's a really great oral history of Saturday Night Live. Yeah, it's a really good one. There's a really good one of the talent agency CAA.
Oh, I bet that's brilliant.
Yeah, it's really good. It should be. I'm sure it is.
I'm sure it's
called
Google's
CAA.
Let's have a look. Yeah. I think we were right by that section.
I think that one came out right when I had the idea, because I saw my husband reading it, because he likes to read oral histories, especially about the entertainment industry. And so, oh, there we go. Yeah, Please Kill Me. That's another one.
Oh, that's a great one.
Yeah. But so I had seen him, I think it was that one that he was reading, and I thought, that's a cool way to write fiction. We haven't seen that yet. That was when I came up with the idea, was seeing these oral histories about nonfiction and then thinking that it was a cool form for fiction.
Because I think it really gives you that compulsive feeling as a reader. You're like, oh my God, get in my face. But did you find it easier or harder to write than traditional prose, or just different?
It was a lot harder at first, because there are totally different rules. You have no narrator. You have no piece of information that you can give the reader that isn't filtered through a character.
Because the joy of it, right, is everyone's contradicting each other.
Right.
Everyone is an unreliable narrator.
Right. And so it was tough at first to figure out how that was going to work, what the rules were. But then once I adapted to it, it was actually really fun, because there's also a lot of things that you don't have to do. I don't have to set the scene. I don't have to describe what people are wearing if it's not relevant. There's a lot of things you can get away with too, and a lot of ways you can subvert the form. So I would say incredibly difficult at first, and then quite easy by the end of it. This, The Soprano Sessions, which came out at the top of the year, it's by Matt Zoller-Seiss and Alan Sepinwall. So it's a whole compendium of episode recaps and analysis and critique about The Sopranos. So my husband is a huge fan of the critic Matt Zeller-Seiss. And so for Christmas last year, I pre-ordered this book, and I said, like, we'll watch all of The Sopranos and binge them and then read these because we're big dorks. And so we did that this year, and it was really great and really fun. And since we are in the entertainment section, I Like to Watch, which is the new book by Emily Nussbaum.
Desperate to read that.
So she's a TV critic for The New Yorker, and her analysis of the way we watch TV, particular shows, why we maybe don't take certain shows seriously when we should, the things that we do take seriously that maybe don't deserve it, all those things, and what it says about us is all in here. I Like to Watch, which is it's a compendium of her best essays, or the ones, maybe not her best, but the ones she chose to put in there. And of course, Save the Cat, which is a book on screenwriting.
The last book on screenwriting, yes, that you'll ever need.
I mean, I do kind of agree with him. It's by Blake Snyder, and almost everyone in Los Angeles that's writing screenplays is reading that book, so that's a big one around
and this
here.
Is what we'll see if we go around to coffee shops and things.
Yeah, probably.
Holding up, if they're not, sat in front of a MacBook, not typing. I think actually I was talking to someone at Netflix who was saying the way we watch TV is kind of closer now to the way we read, because you can just keep going until the end.
Yeah.
If you like, and you can be more ambitious because you don't have to keep kind of, say like on last week's show.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It can be much more novelistic. Do you see that in what you watch?
Yeah, I do. But I also think, like, in general, we have this habit of saying, like, the TV is inherently not good, but good TV is when TV elevates itself to a movie or elevates itself to a novel. And that is true. Like, you look at certain things and I would, Mad Men is novelistic, in that way. But TV is just good in its own merits too.
Which kind of brings us back to The Sopranos, it's obviously like this exactly wealth right. of, I mean, I imagine, I don't know how many books there are about The Sopranos, but I imagine a lot, probably not just that one.
And also ones that they published. Like, I remember in college, somebody gave me for Christmas, like, The Sopranos Italian Cookbook. And I was like, what is this?
Did you make anything out of it?
I don't remember. I just remember being like, I don't know if The Sopranos need their own cookbook, but I'm sure it did well for them.
Oh, I hope so. I want to see that, because I'm sure, I mean, the food's probably delicious, right? However you feel.
Oh, well, Italian food is always, you can't go wrong.
Right, what else have we got?
Well, there's actually, there's a lot here that I read for Daisy Jones, since we're in the music section. So this book, which is Rolling Stone Interviews, and it's, my brother gave this to me to help me with my research. And so you see, like, when you open the table of contents, it's, just the interviews that have been pulled, like John Lennon, Phil Spector, Ray Charles, Truman Capote, Johnny Cash, it just goes on and on. The one that I found really helpful when I was doing my research for Daisy Jones was Tina Turner, Bruce Springsteen, and I believe Neil Young is in here, or maybe I'm crazy.
Yeah, so I read that one, Laurel Canyon, Inside the Story of Rock and Roll's Legendary Neighborhood, which is also great because, that's very close to where we are right now. We're on the Sunset Strip, which is was such a big, the sort of defining space for rock in the 70s.
Michael Walker. So I guess all that, the beginning of the story, when they're kind of in the house.
I put them, it's funny, I put Daisy Jones and the Six in Topanga Canyon instead of Laurel Canyon, although Karen does have a house in Laurel Canyon. But there are so many canyons in Los Angeles, and they all have these very sort of specific connotations, and so I was moving them out west a little bit, but the Laurel Canyon music scene was a huge inspiration for the book, and that's where we are right now, so that's a fun one. Obviously you've got Keith Richards' life, his autobiography, which I scrolled through.
I kind of struggled with that. I was really excited about reading it, and then I'm like, oh, the rock and roll is a little slow to get going.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I will admit I skimmed it, because by the time I was reading that one, I had read so many that I was starting to look for specific details as opposed to larger story.
Yeah.
So for him, I was trying to really understand his approach to playing. And I stole a couple things about, like, specific tuning and things like that from that book. I'm trying to see if they have... it should be in this section, but it could be in a different section. But huge, huge, huge help for me was Bruce Springsteen's memoir, Born to Run.
Oh.
That was a really defining book for me in the process of writing Daisy Jones. Is it here somewhere?
Yeah.
I'm surprised it's tucked away in the corner here.
We should move it. We should put it somewhere sort of front and center.
Yeah, this deserves prominent space. Yeah, I loved this book. And I really wasn't into Springsteen before I read it.
So did you read it because you knew you wanted it for research rather than for
In fact, pleasure? I think I had a sort of attitude of like, I should read this because it had just come out when I was doing my research and I felt like, oh, I should know what he said because he's in the same space that I'm writing about. So it sort of felt like homework. But then I got like 5 pages into it and I was like, I'm an idiot. Bruce Springsteen's the coolest and I've been asleep on the wheel here. And I fell madly in love with Bruce Springsteen to the point where I talk about it way too much.
Going out and say, have you heard of this great singer called Bruce Springsteen? Yeah. He's really good.
I know. I tell this story a lot, but I was in the middle of reading this book and I'm doing my research and I'm watching all these Bruce Springsteen YouTube videos and I'm like, just falling in love with him. And I remember I was having brunch with my mother-in-law and I'd said something like, you know, boy, did you know Bruce Springsteen was like the hottest guy in the 70s? And the look on her face, she was like, you need to know your place right now. She was like, did I know Bruce Springsteen was hot in the 70s? You know, this is another good one, actually, now that we're in the Bruce Springsteen section, which my husband bought this one for me as a gift once I became obsessed. Bruce Springsteen, the stories behind the songs. This is a really cool one.
Can I just say that's a very generous thing for a husband to do.
Yeah.
I have a real thing about this guy. Well, his book.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no. My husband, I wish my husband knew how to be jealous. He's completely incapable of it. He'd be like, go be with Bruce Springsteen if that's what you want.
Is he a fan too, or would he just let you go?
You know, he's very supportive of any whim that I get, but I think in general he likes the music that I started listening to while writing Daisy Jones and the Six more than what I had listened to before, you know, so he's happy with it. He's like, yeah, I'll listen to Springsteen for the 5,000th time if we're not listening to Nicki Minaj for the 5,000th time. So, but this book goes through each of his songs and tells a story behind, you know, why it was written, how it was composed and things like that, which is really interesting. And it has a lot of smoking hot picks, which is also very important.
Do you have a favorite song?
Of Bruce Springsteen's? I'm on Fire. That's my favorite, and it will always be my favorite. And I wish it was written in the 70s. It's, you know, a song from the 80s, but I wanted to put it on all of my Daisy Jones like playlists, and I think I did anyway, even though it didn't actually sync up in the chronology of it.
I think that sometimes a period of time, it can be an idea as much as like a set chronology.
Sure.
And
yeah.
Especially like I think, you know, certainly in the UK, a lot of the 60s, as we think was the 60s, is really happening in the early 70s because it takes longer for everything to filter down than you think.
Well, good. All right. So we'll say that fits then.
As a legitimate
a
notary for music playlists.
All right.
This looks good. You mentioned Nicki Minaj. Not
I know,
Jones
I
related,
should
but
read
I
this.
Read
I haven't
Save
heard
the
Queens, of this before.
The Essential History of Women in Hip Hop.
I have never heard of this book, and now I think I might need it.
Someone I feel is kind of overlooked in hip hop history right now is Foxy Brown.
Oh, sure.
That she, you know,
absolutely.
I don't think that she is remembered. I mean, as far as I know, she's still alive, but in the way that she...
Yes.
So I will save that for later.
And it's also a great title. God Save the Queens.
They've got Gabrielle Union is quoted on there.
Oh,
and then
yeah.
Jason King and Rob Sheffield. I don't want to know what some dudes think about women in hip hop.
That's fair. I care what Gabrielle Union thinks of it, though.
That's it.
This one I've heard is really great that I want to read. This is, I believe, an oral history, too. Ladies Who Punch. Or maybe it's not. No, maybe it's an expose. Yeah.
Everything's an oral history now. I've invented them.
Yeah, right. I wish I could claim.
So what's that? But that's about
this is the
view.
Whole yeah. It's the storyline behind The View, and they're all just, you know, talking trash about each other. I just love a book where people are talking
Can
trash
we read
about
what's
each
on
other.
The back, 'cause it looks...
Please, you know,
I just love that.
Oh, this is great. The only one who didn't succeed, although I thought she was adorable, was Debbie. That's Barbara Walters.
My favorite is Elizabeth Hasselbeck. This woman is driving me nuts. I'm not going back. I can't do the show like this.
It feels like you're joining a new club that doesn't want any new members. That was the hardest part, Meghan McCain. Yeah, see, this is gold. I should buy this book right now.
Ramin Sajidi. Whoopi vented to an executive about how much she hated my book cover, which she discovered online, because it featured an illustration of her sitting at the same table with Rosie. O'Donnell,
are they not on at the same time? Is that the problem?
I'm assuming that was maybe because there was a... I'm going to guess there was a Whoopi Goldberg-Rosie O'Donnell issue, which for legal reasons is purely my conjecture. I will Google that. And I really want to read that Sally Field book as well in pieces.
Yeah.
That. This is getting away from the podcast and more
now we're
shopping.
In Hollywood. Oh, this, so I haven't read this book, but I did see the documentary, Full Service. This is wild. I don't know if I can even recommend this story directly. It is that wild, but it's Full Service, My Adventures in Hollywood and the Secret Sex Lives of the Stars. My book, The Seven Husbands of Evelyn Hugo, has a large part of that storyline is about queer Hollywood and the people that had to hide who they were in order to work. And so Scotty Bowers, who wrote this, claims that he was basically a pimp for all of queer Hollywood. And he outs a lot of people. You know, is it true? Is it not? I don't know. He says a lot of crazy things. But it's certainly an interesting gossipy story.
Oh, this looks great. I wonder if we can, I don't know, if I like lose a limb or something, I might just be able to fit this in my like, in my hold luggage.
Right. I mean, that
I have to wear three pairs of shoes. It's fine.
Yeah. When I was in London, I did the same thing the opposite way, where it was like, I can't fit all of this. I'm shoving books in my pockets.
What books did you buy in London?
Well, you know what? Here's the awful thing. I bought a few because we go to bookstores to sign books, and then I always like to buy something. So I bought all these books for my kid, and then I would go to my publisher and I'd be like, oh, that book looks good, and that book looks good. And then I would just end up with like, you know, a handful of free books that I was like, well, I have to bring these home, you know? The ones I bought for my daughter were, do you know the Little People Big? Oh, is it over here?
Do they have them here?
This is like, I love this series so much. Also, I might have to buy her one of these baby t-shirts.
Oh, it's a David Bowie shirt.
Anyway, there's like these little feminist stories. So basically it'll be, you know, like a story about Frida Kahlo or, let's see, Maya Angelou or Jane Austen. And it's like one book each.
Yes.
Little People, Big Dreams. So whenever I go to a bookstore, like to get my daughter one of these. So I see, I haven't seen Dolly Parton. And I, you know,
wait, keep this out.
I know. Let's see. The ones my daughter has, I don't even think are here. So I might have to stock up while I'm here. Oh, she has Rosa Parks. And then my daughter has Maya Angelou, Frida Kahlo. Who else does she have? Jane Austen, which she's like not nearly as interested in, which I'm bummed about because it starts out and it's like, you know, Jane Austen was a writer. And I'm like, just like your mom. She's like, whatever. Where's Maya Angelou? Like, Maya Angelou was a writer too. But, you know, Lila's just like not interested in anything that is about me. She just wants to, she's obsessed with Frida Kahlo, like completely obsessed. So anyway, so I would go into bookstores and buy stuff like this. And then we also bought her The Tiger Who Came to Tea.
Yeah. One of my absolute favorites.
Which is I don't think huge here in the US. I don't think it took off the same way.
Because it's so set in London,
yeah,
I guess.
It is.
And the specific experience of London.
Yeah.
Kind of, was it written during the Second World War or just after?
I believe so, yeah.
But then I think, you know, you'd think there would be enough Anglophiles.
I would have thought it translated here in a big way, or maybe I just missed it. But anyway, she loves it. So, but that's the kind of stuff that my husband and I were like, you know, squishing them down into the suitcase and sitting on the suitcase to get it zipped.
Have you come across Judith Kerr wrote books that were kind of autobiographical novels, and they're sort of for young adults about her experiences of being a refugee, and they're my favorite books of all time. They're so great. It's called When Hitler Stole Pink Rabbit, and she is, as Anna, she's nine, and her father is a sort of prominent Jewish, like, I think, theatre critic and intellectual and writer, and they have to leave, obviously, and they go to, I think, Switzerland, and then Paris, and then there's one where she's in Paris as a teenager, and then there's one called It's a Small Person Far Away, and then the other way around, but I always get them the wrong way around.
Okay.
There's one like post-war, and it's sort of about her mother dying, but they are great. They're really, really great. I will send them to you.
Oh geez, see, this is
you can't get them
embarrassment
here,
of riches.
They are just,
yeah,
because it sounds like you're short on books.
Yeah, I know, I need more books. You know what, these are also, these two books here, like if anyone has a kid, there's three of these, but they only have two of them. My daughter's obsessed with these, and it gets her to do yoga, which is the cutest thing. So they're called Yoga Bear, Yoga Whale, and they also have Yoga Bug. And anyway, each one is named after, you know, so it's like do lion pose, you know, which is really just lion's breath or whatever
tiger, and it's just she'll entertain herself for, you know, 45 minutes doing these poses. And then, yeah, like,
I that looks about my level of yoga.
Yeah. So you I know might what? Honestly, it's really cute because she'll sit there and she'll do, you know, some not hugely complex, but like fairly complex poses. And she's so proud of herself and, you know, keeps her entertained.
That's really lovely. Is there anything that you're very excited about her reading when she's a little bit older?
Yes. So here's the most awful admission that is going to get me kicked out of this bookstore, which is that I've never read Harry Potter.
I should say, and this might mean we have no more listeners on our podcast ever. Like, I've read not all of the books. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed the ones I did. I'm not like a huge, huge fan. Yeah, so I'm delighted it exists. I'm glad that those books inspire so much love in so many people. But
the minute you say that or admit it, the floor opens up and swallows you whole. It's not.
No.
But I want to read them. I just sort of didn't when everyone was reading them. And then I got this idea right before I had a kid. I was like, let me not read them. Let me purposely not read them, and I'll get to read them for the first time with my kid. But I don't think I understood just how long it takes for a kid to be ready to read Harry Potter. So I'm like, you know, counting down the days. She's 3 now. We have a couple more years to go. I keep saying to my friends, like, my friend has a kid who's 8 and, like, super into Harry Potter. And I was like, okay, when did she read the first one? Like, when can I put it on my schedule that I can start reading Harry Potter with my daughter?
Like, yeah. 18 months to go.
Yeah, exactly.
But it'll be so lovely to experience that world with her for the first time.
That's what I think, you know, and that's why I keep holding out. But I do feel embarrassed when it comes up in conversation. I'm like, give me a few years and I'll be able to
follow
this.
We'll interview you again if this podcast is still going. You'll be there in a hat and a cape. It was.
That's exactly right. I'll be first in line.
What were you reading when you were young?
You know, it's funny. I wasn't
You are still young, but, you know, a child.
I wasn't that much of a reader. Which it's funny looking back, you know, I don't think it took me too long to learn that reading was something that could be fun.
I kind of love hearing people saying that because I think there's so much of a sort of weird inverted snobbery around reading where people are like, I think it's because the people who've always loved it are like, you know, I read as a kid because I had nothing else going on. And so there's this, you know, people are like, no, I have one thing and it's this and you can't have it. But I think it's so thrilling that it's something that always waits for you.
Yeah. And also, you know, like, it takes an attention span, which is a skill that has to be learned. And so, you know, it just wasn't encouraged, and I didn't really get into it. And then I came to it much later. But there were certain books that came up, you know, I would say basically like preteen for me, where I had just heard about it and I was interested in, so I started reading. But like, you know, children's books, like I have like a gap in my knowledge a little bit, like when people are like, oh, The Bridge of Terabithia or Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, and I'm like, uh-huh, those sound good, don't know what they are. I came to it really when Chick Lit started.
So can you remember the first one of the first things you read when you're like, oh, this is what all the fuss is about? Reading might be for me.
I can tell you exactly what it was. Bridget Jones's Diary. That's what it was.
I always think that Bridget Jones is my Harry Potter.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I heard about that book. I heard that everyone thought it was so funny and it was so great or whatever. And I was probably 12 or 13 and I got my hands on it. I don't know how. And I remember looking at the first page and it, you know, it's this journal format. So it seemed much less intimidating.
Kind of like an oral history.
Yes, very much so. And I was like, this doesn't seem hard. This seems fun. And I was reading it and I was laughing and I thought she was just so funny. And it was just wild and fun. And that's when I realized that books weren't something that you had to do. You know, they could be fun as well.
And I do think all of, you know, later, I think people are very critical of that book and they read it with sort of 2019 eyes, like she's obsessed with her weight and she's neurotic. And I think actually she is really spirited and she's courageous when it matters.
Yeah. And I think context matters too. You know, like when I was reading that book, that was the world that I inhabited was when I was told that as I grew up, I needed to be concerned about my weight and that, you know, paying attention to who I was dating and those things were defining traits. That's the world that we lived in. It accurately reflected the world that we lived in.
It's like, you know, as women, we're like, you must be really, really neurotic and paranoid about this.
Right.
And that was the joke that she was.
Absolutely.
Because the way she thinks about her body is kind of ludicrous. And you have to have a bit of a gallows humor about it, I think, and see it as hilarious.
Yeah. And like you can't deny that that's what our world has been like. You know,
sure.
Just because it's changing now doesn't mean it wasn't like that. It was reflecting our culture. You can say that we're fortunate we don't have that culture anymore. And, you know, would I let, you know, when my kid is 13, when I say, oh, you should read Bridget Jones? I don't know, because it's going to feel outdated. And I don't want to introduce those things into her life if they're not already there. It's kind of the same way I feel about Friends.
I wonder whether the context of 1990s London is sort of distracting enough. You'd be like, no, this is just a period piece.
Yeah.
It is like, it is Pride and Prejudice.
But I do think, you know, I think there are ways that our culture is changing that are really good. And so we don't necessarily need to go back to some of the things that are showing us that reflected harmful things in our culture. You know, like it worked at the time. It made me feel less alone. It entertained me. It has value. I can put it in the context of that. Not everyone can.
But there's so much exciting new things that are being made now where
That's
it's like we don't
true.
Need to.
Yeah.
I know what you mean. Yeah. It's, I suppose, like video games, like anything, isn't it? You know, anything can be.
Absolutely.
Like the Bible. It all goes very wrong in the wrong hands.
Right. That's exactly right.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com. Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
We'll be back to Taylor soon, but now it's time for my Steal of the Week, a book so precious that you can imagine George Clooney and Brad Pitt hatching an elaborate plan to steal it. This week, it's How to Break Up with Fast Fashion by Lauren Bravo, former guest and friend of the podcast and of me. Lauren has written a tender, cheering and emotional book about a love-hate relationship with the fashion industry, specifically the production part. She has a compassionate and practical plan to help us shop with joy while limiting our impact on the planet. It's full of wit, warmth and wisdom, and most importantly, Lauren is not making any of us attempt to put together a capsule wardrobe. That's How to Break Up with Fast Fashion by Lauren Bravo, published by Headline Home. Now back to Taylor. Oh, you just come across Dr. Seuss. Are you a fan?
We're a big fan of Dr. Seuss in the house, which what's kind of funny is that, so my brother, his name's Jake, and he bought my daughter Lila, I think, like her first Dr. Seuss book or something. So she's confused and she thinks that her uncle Jake wrote all of Dr. Seuss's books. So she will read like, oh, the places you'll go, and she thinks it's written by Uncle Jake.
I can't wait for her to get to school or playgroup and whatever, be like, that's my uncle.
I know. Well, what's also funny is in Oh, the Places You'll Go, there's actually very specifically a part where they go to a waiting place. So there's an area where people are just waiting for a train to go or a bus to come or a plane to go. It goes on and on and on, and then it says waiting perhaps for their Uncle Jake or a pot to boil or a better break, and Lila's just like, oh, it's Uncle Jake. Like, you know, it's like he didn't write this book, he's not in this book, but for her he is Oh, the Places You'll Go.
That is the most adorable thing I ever heard.
Pretty great. This is also a book not for children that came out recently that I actually am doing a giveaway because I really loved it and I want to support her. It's called Three Women by Lisa Taddeo. It's nonfiction. It's about three women that she's very specifically chosen, and she sort of details this specific part of their love/sex lives that is really gripping and heartbreaking and beautiful, and you know, look, it's a narrow
I should, it's three white women, you know, yeah. But it's a very interesting book and I really liked it.
I love that book. And yeah. I was so kind of blown away by the consistency, like mm-hmm. the time mm-hmm. that as an act of journalism, I think yes. it's so impressive. But also what crushed me was, because I think, and I know a few people who read it, it's come up before, I think, on this podcast, because everyone's either like just read it or about yeah. to read it because it's just come out and it's been so huge in the UK. Mm-hmm. But I think people were kind of expecting a raunchy read, and then they were a bit taken aback by the fact that it's so much about women being let down and kind of, you know, gaslit and made to feel ashamed of their feelings, and like just that awful feeling that you're, as a woman, that it's not safe to desire, like, romantically. And something that I was, not that I took from it as a lesson, but that made me sad, is I feel like we're in some places, it's a very Western thing, but at a point where to desire sex is safer than to desire romance or love that kind of connection.
Yeah. Well, these are three, I would say, fairly disempowered women mm. who are trying to grab some agency. But
and it's interesting that the happiest woman, who seems to have the least awful time, Sloane, she's definitely the most privileged. She's got the most kind of
the most privileged, and also money. You know, I don't think, I mean, you get to the end of the book and is she doing what she wants to be doing? I don't know. I'm not sure she wants to be doing those things. I thought it was really interesting, and I thought Good and Mad was really interesting, which is by Rebecca Traister. It's specifically about women's anger. Really great book. As women start embracing our anger more. I'm definitely all for characters that are angry. And so that's a really good one.
I think all the time about, I think it's Susie in Curb, who's described as being like, she's cold in her anger.
Right.
And I was like, that's what I want. Yeah. I want to feel angry, but yes. not to have that like, yes. to just be yeah.
Or productive anger, mm. right? To feel angry and then to feel like you can do something about it. To have the agency to make it useful.
At the time of recording, the holidays are coming up. Have you got any book gifting plans?
Oh my gosh. Well, everyone gets books for me.
I've just finished that.
Oh, yeah? Yeah, Eve Babbitt's. Come on. I mean, especially to be here. Eve Babbitt's has strong Daisy Jones vibes.
I was going to ask, actually. Yeah. I really wanted to ask about that.
I had in my head, I think I had to do some question and answer thing, I think, for Hello Sunshine, which is Reese Witherspoon's company. And they were like, tell us something that nobody knows about Daisy Jones. And I like really thought about it for a while, and I was trying to think of a good answer. And I was like, she would hate Eve Babbitt's because Eve Babbitt's is so similar to her, and she would love Joan Didion in terms of, you know, Los Angeles women writers. I feel like Daisy Jones would love Joan Didion, which we've got Joan Didion's The White Album here, Slouching Towards Bethlehem, South and West, all good stuff.
Joan Didion is a present someone. That's quite a statement. Yeah. I don't know how, what yeah. person to feel.
Well, also, you know, I feel the thing about books, and I feel very strongly about this, is that I give books to people because I hope that they'll enjoy it, and I hope that they'll have a good experience. Mm-hmm. But I've given books to people, and you know, sometimes you get it wrong. They're not interested in that book, and I always say, like, return mm-hmm. it. Like, I even say to my friends about my books, it's like, they'll be like, it's next on my list to read. And I'm like, don't read it. Like, reading should never be a chore. I think that's why I didn't read for as long as I did, because I thought it was a chore. It shouldn't be. Like, there's stuff that you read because you want to get an education or you want to learn or whatever, fine, you do that. But, you know, read what you love and don't spend time reading something you don't. So I always try to find books that I think people would really enjoy. But it's always with a gift receipt. And it's like, if you don't want this book, go back to the bookstore and find one that you'll enjoy reading. Because I don't ever want anyone... It's just not fun, you know?
I think that's a really good philosophy to have. And I think when you have a lot of... And what you were saying about blurbing and things, and, you know, I'm sure I've got a lot of friends who are writers. Sometimes I feel as though there are more people who are writing books I need to read than who might read anything I write. Right. And that constant kind of... To free your friends from that, that's a generous thing.
Yes, well...
Do you know of any books you have given that have not been quite the hit you hoped they'd be?
Oh, I can tell you exactly. This is pretty much like when I realized that I needed to be mindful of the books that I was giving. So when my husband and I first met, and the context for this is that my husband actually doesn't enjoy reading that much, which is ironic that... first of all, he's a screenwriter, so that's one thing. But then also, you know... I write novels, and he doesn't really read novels. And so I had just met him, and he
really likes true crime, and he did. It's funny, now that true crime is, like, in the zeitgeist, I think he's had his fill, but back in 2008 when I met him, he was really into it, and specifically serial killers. He was, like, really fascinated by the psychology of them, and anyway, I'm thinking, I'm gonna be such a great girlfriend. I come down here to Book Soup, because I lived down the street at the time, and I get In Cold Blood by Truman Capote. Because he'd never read it, and it's, you know, the true crime. And he's such a nice person, and he's got such a sweetheart, and he would do anything for anybody. And I give him this book, and he's like, oh, thank you. Thank you so much. And I'm like, great. And it was just awkward, and suddenly he seemed, like, so down. And I finally was like, is something the matter? And he goes, I just really don't feel like reading this book. And I was like, don't read it. I was like, I'm giving it to you because I wanted you to have an enjoyable experience, not because I want you to owe me, you know, a paper on In Cold Blood. So anyway, we returned it.
Yeah, he got something else seminar he wanted. Week.
Yeah.
Bring you a notebook.
Yeah. So that was when I learned that you gotta give people some space to like what they like and don't try to.
I love this book because I feel like that is very much what the book lover would give the true crime fan. Right. Like, this is both our worlds coming together.
And he's like, nope, I just like watching, you know, documentaries about this stuff.
Oh, look at this. Oh, hold on. Wait a minute. Legendary authors and the clothes they wore. Ooh.
This might be an auto buy for me. This is pretty great.
Oh, I like that picture.
Signature looks. T.S. Eliot. Oh, gotta love F. Scott and Zelda Fitzgerald. Love it.
The pockets are bunched, I think, with miniatures.
Dorothy Parker, F. Scott Fitzgerald.
Dorothy Parker looks very Hepburn-y.
I know. I kind of thought it was Audrey Hepburn. Both of them, Audrey Hepburn and F. Scott Fitzgerald, lived just at Crescent Heights and Sunset, just not far from where we are now. The intersection of Crescent Heights and Sunset is actually where the Laurel Canyon scene begins there, maybe, is Laurel Canyon. But anyway, they both lived at what was called the Gardens of Allah, which is right there on the corner. It's now a McDonald's and a bank. These things happen. Oh. But that's what Joni Mitchell wrote, They Paved Paradise and Put Up a Parking Lot. That's what that's about. So it all... Right? It's oh, that's funny. This is called The Six.
Oh.
The Lives of the Mitford Sisters. This looks really
good,
too.
Do you know the Mitford Sisters?
Only very little. I don't know that much about them. Looks like a great book. And all these are on sale? What are we doing? $8 for this? I gotta grab that.
Those are... I think if you like Jane Austen, you will probably love... the eldest, Nancy, was the novelist. And her books are really, 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 really funny. And, you know, just, again, books... I love books about sisters and, you know, it's just about women being together and being crazy.
I mean, come on, Valley of the Dolls.
The anniversary edition.
Yeah, this is a great one. This is actually a book that Daisy Jones reads, which was very much on purpose that she would be. Yeah, I mean, this actually is a great addition too. I mean, this does feel in some ways like a book I think all women would enjoy reading. It's just so wild and salacious, and I mean, there's no question of even whether it's good or bad. It just is the Valley of the Dolls.
I think for me, it reminds me of what you were saying when I read it. Like, you're allowed to read books like this, and you're allowed to write books like this.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Yeah. Exit West is another great one by Mohsin Hamid. He narrates the audiobook, which is how I read it, listened to it. And I really think when it comes to fiction, it's difficult for fiction authors to be great narrating their audiobooks, and boy, does he nail it. Oh my God, his performance is incredible. This book is great. He's great when you listen to it. It's just
I don't know
fantastic.
This, but I'm already desperate to listen. So
it's a good one. I mean, it's magical realism, I guess, because a lot of it can't technically have happened. Part of the thing is it's this sort of refugee world, and they're these two main characters, is this love story between them, and yet they have to leave this war-torn area that they're in, and they start walking through doors, and that, like, allows them to escape where they are. So it's, I guess, magical realism. I don't know if the book describes it that way, but it's what it feels like to me.
Beautiful. Do you listen to many audiobooks?
I do, but it has to be a specific thing, because I think sometimes I lose... It's harder for an audiobook to keep my attention. Mm. It's like time and place is a little bit more difficult, but yeah, I'm listening to The Silent Patient right now in audio, which is really good.
I don't know that book. Who's it by?
Oh, God. It's like such a big book here. I'm going to butcher his name, but I think it's Alex Michaelides. I think that's how you say it. It's this book about this woman who has ostensibly committed a murder of her husband, but has not spoken a word since for decades. And this psychologist who's coming to try to crack her open for once and for all. I'm like maybe a third of the way into it, but people love it. It's sold really well here. It's been on all the big lists. It's a big one.
I am moving us over to the art section because I saw this book earlier and I thought it'd be fun for us to have a look at. Bibliostyle, How We Live at Home with Books.
Oh, that's great.
So where are your books? Are they displayed sort of beautifully elegantly, or are they everywhere?
That is a great question because I just moved. I moved last week. And the question of where the books are going is a very big question. I'm torn between the formal living room and my office because I liked having all my books in my office because I can see them. And when people say, oh, what book do you recommend? I can look at my bookshelf and be like, oh, I just read that one and that one was great. And makes it easier. But I also think having a nice formal living room with all of your books where you can just get cozy and pull one off the shelf is nice. So I'm very torn about this. But I am putting in a children's library at the top of the stairs for my daughter, which I'm excited about. I've already started a library for her, which is really for me because she doesn't care if she has copies of, you know, Pride and Prejudice and Jane Eyre, but I do.
I think it's really important, isn't it, to see things and these yes. names. Like, I remember it, you know, like my parents have a lot of weird books and all those like 70s Pam McMillan ones. And those titles just like seep into your head mm-hmm. and you don't know, but to have them there as kind of tactile objects you can come to when the mood takes you.
Yeah. They have done studies that having physical books around makes a child much more likely to pick them up. So, you know, I'll make her this library and curate it and have fun doing it, you know, and in the hopes that one day she may look at the shelf and pull one off of there. But I have to, I know, I want it so bad I may just end up with a kid like I was who doesn't read much at all. So,
morbid
yeah.
fear of books.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Well, there's a picture here of it's a bookshop in Mexico City, and mm-hmm. that's the most books I've ever seen
yeah,
on a
this
page.
Stresses me
They've
out.
Got the ladder.
I need much
They've
more order than this. I am much more neurotic about placement of things. I really like. I need an order of like what books are where, so I can easily find them, even if the order only doesn't. It makes sense to no one but me. Like, in my head, I'm like, oh, this is a shelf for books I really love. This is a book for shelves that I mostly love. This is a book for shelves that I've read and I think are good, but not, you know. It's like I get,
that
I have
makes
a whole
so
plan.
Much sense to me. Like, I'd love to have a kind of, like, a proper, like, to-read shelf mm-hmm. and organize that. And, like, I know what's coming out when.
Yes,
and,
exactly.
You know, books that I'm likely to kind of use for reference. And do you keep all your books? Do you ever have clear outs? That sounds like a, because if you do, please donate them too. I'm just
no.
curious.
I mostly keep them. Yeah. I mean, I donate to libraries, that's I guess, but it's tough too when you get like advanced reader copies of stuff. It's like, well, what do I do with this? You know? So yeah, I mostly keep everything. And there are some things that I'll read because I get an advanced reader copy or I get, you know, I borrowed it from somebody or whatever and you read it and you love it. And then I think, well, now I got to go buy my own copy and have it in my library, you know, which is one of those things where I will sometimes buy a book that I've already read. I don't even crack it open. I just need it there on the shelf with the others that I love.
To see, to have that physical presence.
Exactly.
Ooh, for the love of books, designing and curating a home library.
Oh yeah. We're in the book design section, I guess.
I love that this exists.
All of these books are things that I will just buy and own, and I don't need to, and so I have to...
Just open up the checkbooks in our homes. How do they get there?
Yeah.
Well, in my case, 1,000 jiffy bags.
Yeah.
If I wasn't luggage restricted...
Yeah, you're in a bad section for luggage restricted.
Yeah, there's no way any of this is getting
huge
in the case.
And beautiful.
Well, let's go over to where your book is.
Oh, wow. Oh, my gosh. That's quite prominently displayed. I had no idea. Although it is high. not as easy for short people to get.
And you're right by Sally Rooney.
I'll take it. A lot of good books here.
Well, how does it feel to see your own book in a bookshop?
It feels great. It feels great, and you know what? It's been a hard won victory, because for years a lot of my books were not stocked in bookstores. So my first book came out, and I remember going to Barnes & Noble, and it was like, nope, not there. You know, it was just not anywhere. And then it was like the second book, now it's a little bit more, and the third book's a little bit more, and then I think it was by the fourth book that it started to show up places. And so now on the sixth book, to see they've got multiple copies, it's right there in the front, it's staring out at you, it feels good. It's among so many great ones too, which that I've wanted to read. This is like, when I talk about wanting to grab each one and be like greedy with my time, it's like Gods of Jade and Shadow I really want to read. Normal People, Sally Rooney book. I haven't read that one yet. I read her first one.
I think
a lot of people like it more, right?
Yeah, I suppose because it's so. Okay, it's a story that I don't know before. It's very complicated, and I think it's tricky. No one comes out of it well in Normal People. But again, it feels, I suppose, very subtle and very adult. It's really sad, but really great.
That's what I've heard. There's a lot here. A Woman Is No Man, I really want to read.
I've not heard about that.
That one, I think, came out around the same time as mine. Yes.
Oh, shit. I'm so sorry.
And sorry, Salman Rushdie.
That is key shot. So I just threw it at Taylor. There you go. Back you go. Keyshot, I quite liked, actually.
I didn't read it. I haven't read it yet.
I had to read all the Booker books, and it was much more. I was a bit like, oh, it's going to be a bit, you know, worthy. Yeah. But it is great fun. All right, so A Woman Is No Man by Echevarrum. So this sounds, is it maybe in the same sort of family of theme as that the audiobook you were talking about?
Oh, you know, I mean, it's about Palestinian Americans, right? Yeah, I think in America.
And about people who have love affairs and romantic feelings that are thwarted by the situations they're in, the place they're in.
Yeah, I want to read that one. Copperhead, I want to read. I was just on a panel with Alexei Zentner. He sounds like such an interesting person. And this book is about white supremacy specifically. But I think the whole thing is that the main character's stepfather is a white supremacist, and the main character is trying to wrestle with, you know, knowing that the way he was raised was wrong and trying to get himself out of it. And it sounds really interesting. And the story behind why he wrote it sounded great. He's just a great guy. Tana French is great. Her detective novels are so good. Yeah, she's great.
Witch Elm, is that her new one?
This one here. I think they're making her stuff into a TV show for Stars.
Oh, cool.
So I'm excited about, because they're great books, but they would be great TV shows too.
Is that, if you could, obviously, other than your books, which I think are in the works, right? Mm-hmm. If I gave you $100 billion to adapt anything, you could do it as a TV show, you could do it as a movie, you could do the casting, however you wanted. What would you? You have to choose one thing.
What a fun question with so many answers. The thing that comes to mind first, I think, is The Song of Achilles by Madeline Miller. I loved that one. It's one of my favorite books. I talk about it all the time. But I would love to just watch it. You know, just someone else make it. I just want to watch it. It was a really great book, and I think that's the book that I've pressed into the most people's hands. Please read this.
Because I'm desperate to read Circe, and everyone's recommended that to me. Really, and it's good. One of those, like, I don't know why I've not got to it yet, but I will.
It's really good. Circe's really good. I love both of her books. I'll read anything that
did
she
you
writes.
Did you like Song of Achilles more?
I did, only because it's more of a traditional structure. So it's like, it's really like about Achilles in the Trojan War and his relationship with Patroclus, whereas Circe is a little bit more, you know, episodic. You go through the times in her life as they unfold. But I love them both.
Oh, here we have Uncussing by Catherine Dunn and Everything Is Fucked by Mark Manson.
Yeah, I will say I very briefly read part of The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck, and it is lovely. I think that I could use a lot more not giving a fuck, so actually, this whole shelf I'm down for. How to Stop Feeling Like Shit. Fuck That's Delicious. It's all good stuff.
Fucking Good Manners.
Yeah.
They're the fucking books.
The holy shit moment. How lasting change can happen in an instant. Okay. I'm down.
Do you have that with your books? Do you have a moment when the story, when that, or are you able to trace back the point when, like, the first seed or grain kind of started to shake down and sprout?
You know, sort of, but I think a lot of it is that it all happens very slowly. You take one piece from here and one piece from here, and it starts to snowball, and at some point you realize it's taken on a life of its own, and it's got legs, and it's going to go, for mixing metaphors. But I do think that now, after it's written, it becomes a lot easier to create a narrative of, like, I knew when, you know? And I think any of my answers about that can only be half true. Because at the time, there's so many different pieces of information that are coming through your head, so many things you're living at one time when you're coming up with an idea. You're influenced by so many things.
I mean, I found it really kind of inspiring, I guess, when you talked about how, you know, this has been to make it like we're in The Bachelor for a second, a journey.
Yes, you this know, has been a journey.
It's, you know, books and books and books, and you keep writing and keep doing it, and each one there's sort of a little more of a...
Mm-hmm.
A moment. I mean, does that, do you feel like that gives you a sort of perspective on the difference between what writing is and what publishing a book is? Or
yeah, that's a really interesting question. I think it's one of those things where if you asked me when I was coming out with my debut, which was now, I guess, 7 years ago, I would have said I want to be one of those people that gets famous off of their debut novel. Who doesn't? It didn't happen for me, and it took me a while to get up that mountain. And I think now that I'm here and I feel good about where my career is at, I can look back on it and say, I'm really thankful for the way that I'm folded. Mm. I think I have a pretty good perspective. I understand that these things come and go, that, you know, I have a book that's done well, and that's a nice thing for me now. Mm. Nothing's promised. I have no idea what tomorrow looks like. So I'm appreciating it in the moment. I think if it had been given to me, my first book came out, I was 29. And I think if I had taken off like a rocket then, I don't know. I don't think it would have been good for me long term. So I'm really happy with the way that it's gone down. Each victory, small things of like, oh, this place covered it, or this, it's on this list, or these things that, again, sort of snowball into a successful book. I can appreciate each one because I spent a lot of time not getting any of those things. But so many times it seems like, oh, you're going to publish a book and now you're going to be a New York Times bestseller. Yeah, there's an assumption that every book is going to be this huge success. And, you know, success looks different for each book. But I'm happy to have grown slowly.
Huge thanks to Taylor. Follow her at T Jenkins Read on social media. Daisy Jones and the Six is published by Cornerstone and out now in paperback. It's a future classic. It's furious, feminist, glamorous and smart, and I defy you not to fall in love with Daisy. Also, huge thanks to everyone at BookSoup for their kindness, generosity and welcome. Please pay them a visit if you're in Los Angeles and follow them on social media at BookSoup for reading inspiration. I'm Daisy Buchanan, and I have been your book inspector. Thank you so much for joining me, fellow bibliomaniacs. You can find me on Twitter at NotRollerGirl and on Instagram at TheDaisyBee. Say hello, suggest some guests, and watch out for shelfies. Visit our show page, acast.com/booked, for more information about our guest and a list of the books they talked about. If you have any other queries about the podcast, you can email us at whybooked@gmail.com. Your Book is produced by Dale Shaw for New Alaska and hosted by Acast. Please do subscribe, rate us, and leave a review. It's great to hear what you think, and it helps other people to find the podcast. For now, I leave you with these words that are thought to have been said by the playwright Verenc Molnár. Writing is like sex. First you do it for love, then you do it for your friends, and then you do it for money.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.